Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Host Tucker Perkins recorded this special episode from Reuters Energy Transition North America in Houston, where he talked to business leaders and other experts at the forefront of driving climate innovation. Now, here's Tucker.
We're really pleased to welcome Cindy Taff, CEO of Sage Geosystems. Cindy is an oil and gas industry veteran who's on the forefront of the energy transition by leading a company offering innovative geothermal solutions. Cindy, so glad to have you today. Thanks for stopping by and welcome to Path to Zero.
Well, thank you for having me.
What a great career. We're going to talk about a lot of things, and you know, we really haven't talked a lot about geothermal, so I'm excited about that. But let's start by having you tell us just a little bit about Sage Geosystems and maybe the technology and how it fits into geothermal and kind of the rest of that renewable energy landscape that you compete with.
Yeah, so it's exciting. And I'm going to bring into the conversation energy storage. Okay, so Sage is a geothermal and energy storage company. So we started out focusing on geothermal. Because of our oil and gas background, we got to the field quickly and we recognized that we had the perfect energy storage solution. So what we're doing is we're going to build our first power plant, which will be an energy storage power plant. But let me tell you a little bit more about the energy storage. So if you think about pumped storage hydropower, so when you're pumping a lake up a mountain, and then you release that water from the mountain when the demand peaks, that's what we're doing. Now, pumped hydro storage does not get a lot of play in the media because it's been around forever, but it's very reliable, it's very cost effective. And so what we're doing is pumped hydro, but we're doing it deep in the earth. So what we do is we drill a well, we install a frack in a very impermeable formation. When the demand is low, we take that electricity, we power an electric pump, we pump that water into the fracture, that fracture will balloon open. You shut the wellhead valve, and then that water is trapped in that fracture under pressure. When the demand peaks, you open that wellhead valve, that fracture is wanting to close, and when it does, it jettisons the water back to the surface. And then you put it through a Pelton turbine, same turbines that are being used for pumped hydro, and you generate electricity, but you're generating electricity from the pressure energy of the water.
Now, and not from the warmth of the water, but from the pressure of the water.
Correct. Now let's talk about geothermal, because our energy storage technology segue directly to geothermal. For geothermal, we drill the well deeper, where we're trying to hit at least 150 degrees C formation temperatures, and then we have a different power plant system. We don't use a Pelton turbine. So what we're doing now in the geothermal is we are moving that water, rather than from the well to the surface, we're moving that water from one well to another, but we're moving it in the surface so that you're not having to go through fractures at 20,000 feet. So we really think we've cracked the nut on, this is called EGS, geothermal. It's been around for 40 years. There's never been a commercial power plant, and it's because it is not cost effective. And we think we've cracked the nut on making it cost effective.
And what's different about yours that makes it cost effective?
So in traditional EGS systems, you'll have at least two wells. One's going to be a producer and one's going to be an injector. And so the first thing you have to do is you have to connect those wells in the subsurface with a frack. That's difficult to do. But once you have those wells connected in the subsurface, you're going to be pushing water or pumping water between the two wells through that fracture. There is a huge amount of friction in those fractures as you're pushing that water through the fracture. So that energy expended actually takes away from your net output. And so, you know, your net output's going to be diminished, meaning that your cost or your LCOE is also going to be diminished because of that. One other thing that we do differently is, because we operate our fractures in an open position, the friction in our fracture is very low. But because we're also moving that fluid between the two wells and the surface, one thing we don't do is vent the pressure energy. So All other geothermal systems, even traditional geothermal that's been around for over 100 years, vents the pressure. And even though the pressure energy portion of the enthalpy equation is very low, it actually, being able to convert pressure to energy or to electricity has a much higher efficiency than converting heat to electricity.
In the plant you're building, what is the approximate size of it in terms of power output?
Yeah, for the energy storage, we're building a Pelton turbine that's going to be 5,000 PSI and 5 megawatts. For geothermal, we're building a 3 megawatt prototype. It's actually already built. It's in San Antonio. It's on the Southwest Research Institute property. It's actually on the DOE CO2 flow loop. And what we're going to be doing is testing this, putting hot CO2 through it, generating electricity, and then measuring the efficiency of the turbine and of the system.
And the locations that, as you think about how to expand this, the locations would be anywhere that's kind of oil and gas country today, right, where you have those kinds of fractures that you can find. Are you drilling them fresh, or are you using old fracks?
Yeah, it's difficult to reuse existing oil and gas wells because they're too small. For geothermal, you have such a huge mass flow rate that you need to get that amount of heat out of the ground. You have to have like a 10-inch minimum size casing, whereas onshore wells typically have a 5-inch casing. And so going back to your original question, we are targeting places that we can drill to 150 degrees C at a depth of 22,000 feet or shallower, meaning that we can use existing oil and gas equipment to drill to those depths. So I can give you an example. We have a test well in Starr County in Texas. It was drilled in 2008 by the oil and gas industry to a depth of 19,000 feet, and it had a bottom hole temperature of 235 degrees C, which is way hotter than what we need. So, I mean, it's a perfect well. It's just too small.
You know, we really just don't talk much about geothermal. Certainly we don't ever talk about this type of geothermal. And in talking with people even about pump storage, the traditional kind of pump storage, to your point, pumping water up into a building or dropping blocks from the top, there doesn't seem to be much discussion about that kind of pump storage as a future energy source. Do you tend to agree with that? They don't talk about that type of pump storage.
Yeah, if you're specifically talking about pumped hydro, the challenges with pumped hydro is you need a mountain. So with our pumped hydro, you don't need a mountain, so it's not geographically limited. Your footprint is huge because you're having to flood at the bottom of the mountain, at the top of the mountain, and then permitting takes decades. So there's a lot of pumped hydro facilities that are in permitting, so they're being permitted because everybody knows we need storage because of wind and solar doing such a great job of greening the grid, but we need storage to move.
You need storage for sure.
And so there's a lot of pumped hydro storage in progress, but again, it takes up a lot of, it's large footprint. You need a mountain. Permitting takes decades, and quite frankly, the tallest pumped hydro facility is 3,000 feet. We are going down between 7,000 and 12,000 feet. And so the energy density that you see, the energy density from our operations are going to be much greater because it's in proportion to the water column.
Are you keeping this technology inside the U.S., or do you even see it being able to expand outside of North America?
Oh, absolutely. No, we're working with a company in the Middle East, currently doing a feasibility study for them. It's really, the storage is going to be applicable where there's already a lot of wind and solar. So think about California and Texas. It's going to be applicable in remote areas. So think about mining operations or, communities that have energy poverty. We can combine our storage with solar and give, communities 24/7 baseload. So, yeah, there's a lot of applications for the storage.
So the one barrier would be just cost, I guess. But as I think about it, the purists, the people who kind of leave it in the ground, find a lot of fault with generally fracking. And you're doing some of that similar. Do you think You think that the environmental activists could get behind this kind of technology, even though to a degree it feels a little bit like modified oil and gas?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's interesting. We've talked to the regulatory authorities in Germany and in California, where they're, you know, pretty restrictive. And when they look at what we're doing, they said that's not really fracturing because we're using a different process than oil and gas. They call it stimulation. Our philosophy is we're going to be very transparent on what we're doing, and if, you know, regulatory agency considers it stimulation, great. If they consider it fracking, that's fine as well. But we're using non-toxic fluids. It's water with a weighting material and polymer. That's all it is.
No secret additives.
No secret additives. Yeah. No, you know, nasty chemicals. And the other thing is, because we're fracking with a weighted fluid, we can frack with the rig pumps. So those big frack fleets that you see going down the road, we don't need frack fleets to frack. And so the, you know, the community impact's going to be less because you're not having these big trucks driving down the road.
In your space, I know you come out of Shell, and I guess Sage is a variety of ex-Shell people. Anybody else backing it, DOE behind you, Breakthrough, or any of these other people behind you?
Yeah, I mean, the DOE has a lot of programs out there. We've applied to probably a handful of programs. Just recently, we applied to an EGS funding with two different companies, one with Repsol and one with a company in California called CRC. They're an oil and gas company. So, yeah, DOE has been very supportive. We haven't gotten any funding on our own. You know, there's different investors out there that are interested in the energy transition. One of our seed investors is a guy named Chris Anderson. He owns TED Talks. He's a climate investor, and quite frankly, he's been our biggest advocate. He's been great to work with, always a continuous supporter. And so, yeah, we're seeing some really nice support from different facets of the industry.
Do you have a position on geothermal as go down a level to residential or commercial scale systems? Do you think, is it a reasonable technology at that scale?
You know, it's a great question. It's not really what we're focused on.
Right.
Now,
okay.
You know, definitely, I mean.
It's just not in the conversation very much is
it's
why
not.
I ask that.
In fact, you know, we have a place in the country, we're building a new house, and I had that same conversation with the contractor, and he said, yeah, I can build you one, but I'm not sure if I know anybody that could, you know, maintain it for you or repair it for you. And so, unfortunately, I think in different communities it's more prevalent, but in a lot of communities it's not. But from what I hear, it's, you know, it makes sense. You're basically pumping water to that subsurface area where it's always the same temperature.
Right.
So whether it's cold outside or hot outside, you know, it's gonna help your energy costs because
you kind of have a 50-ish degree solution at you. Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the fun. We love to kind of use a magic wand, and you got such a great background. If you could have a magic wand to do one thing in the next year that would have the biggest impact on the energy transformation, how would you use that wand?
All right, so if I had a wand, I would remind people that this is an energy transition, that this is not a switch that you can flip. So let me give you a little bit of background. So for the last 25 years, energy demand has doubled. For the next 25 years, energy demand is expected to double. And so to green that last 25 years, plus make sure that the next 25 years is green, it's gonna take a lot of work. And the thing I don't think a lot of people realize is that the process to generate electricity, it's an industrial process, it's costly, you know, upfront CapEx. And it's a challenge. And so even developing new technologies to generate electricity is challenging. So it's something that I think the whole industry is working hard on. And it's just going to take time. But we need to realize it is a transition, and you shouldn't be turning things off before you can turn something back on.
Yeah, I don't think many people really understand. In fact, I don't know that most people understand where electricity comes from or
yes.
how it's made, how it's transported, certainly how it's stored.
Absolutely. I agree with you.
And I think Texas has been such an interesting lesson in the grid because of ERCOT and kind of the reluctance to cross-connect outside of Texas. But, yeah, I just don't think most people understand. What do you think? You know, you come from big oil and gas, and so many people seem to discount big oil and gas as being a part of the solution. I'm kind of in the other camp that the scale is such, the capital requirements are such, the human needs are so much that whatever solutions happen probably will be executed by big energy. Now, you're the perfect example, Shell, now Sage. What is the role of big oil and gas in this transformation?
Well, let's talk about service companies first. So I feel like service companies already recognize that the transition into energy renewables is important. You know, they've got people with skills. They've got equipment. All of that can be put to work yet tomorrow for new geothermal type of processes and projects. When you look at the larger integrated oil and gas companies, I do think they're still trying to find their way on where they fit. But my reflection is, you know, being ex-Shell, is that they do have the skills. They have the subsurface characterization people. They've got supply chain people. They have project management. They have drilling and completion people. They have so they have all, as far as geothermal, they have all of the skills that they need that they could segue right now. Now, the challenge is, you know, again, I think I mentioned it earlier, EGS has been around for 40 years, and there has never been a commercial power plant. So somebody has to crack that nut. And I think maybe that's when oil and gas, the majors will come in, is once that nut's been cracked and we can actually build and run a commercial power plant that's cost effective.
And we're hoping that Sage Geosystems does that soon. When do you think your plant will be up and able to produce power?
Yep. So our energy storage power plant, we're looking at third quarter. And what I do want to emphasize is just because it's energy storage doesn't mean we're not doing geothermal. We are doing geothermal. What we'll learn from the energy storage is kind of like when you walk before you run. It'll allow us to run the facility, know how to operate the well, and then what we'll do, drill the well deeper, hotter, put a new facility on, and we'll be ready to go for a geothermal late 2025.
Awesome. Great use. All right, well, last thing for you. We love to plant a tree in a national forest in honor of the time you spent with us today. We love hearing our guests think about where that forest should be. Do you have a favorite forest?
Redwoods. Yeah.
Interesting.
When I was a kid, we used to go to the Redwoods, and I just think that's one of the most beautiful areas in the country. So,
now, are you a native Texan?
I was born in Texas. My dad was in the oil field, so we moved around quite a lot. And California was where I was when I was a kid. And then
those Redwoods are a long ways from here, but they are beautiful.
They are beautiful.
And they need more.
Yes.
The good choice. We are so happy to have you join us. Really wish you the best of luck and love talking about geothermal and this because it's not in the conversation. And
we agree.
You think about clean energy, it really has to be at the top of one's list.
We agree.
Good.
And storage.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tucker.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.